From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Whether one knows one will lose or one will win, I would rather lose this war than not fight it, you know?
The great writer Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things, she faces prison for speaking out against the privatization of rivers, energy, and other resources in India. We'll speak to her in New Delhi. And Palestinian suicide attacks continue. Israeli forces intensify commando raids in crowded Palestinian refugee camps. We'll get a report from inside the state of siege. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S. military base in Afghanistan was attacked by rockets today as ground fighting resumed in the biggest U.S.-led ground attack of the Afghan war on Taliban and al-Qaeda forces. CNN is reporting there have been multiple U.S. fatalities during today's battles. Unconfirmed reports say that Canadian, Australian, Danish, German, and French forces and planes joined U.S. troops in the operation around Gardez that started early Saturday morning. The Washington Post reported upwards of 1,000 U.S. and other Western military personnel have been deployed. The fierce resistance from rebel forces repulsed the U.S.-led offensive on Saturday, forcing Afghan fighters and U.S. advisors to withdraw close to Gardez. The region remains under constant bombardment by B-52s and jet fighters. Meanwhile, according to U.S. war officials, Pentagon forces used a deadly bunker-busting bomb in Afghanistan over the weekend. It was the first time the thermobaric bomb was used in the U.S. attacks. The bomb was among the more than 80 pieces of ordnance dropped on Saturday by U.S. warplanes. The bomb belongs to the category of so-called fuel-air munitions. It's capable of penetrating deep underground to reach hidden command bunkers or caves and explode upon hitting its target. Its explosive charge is designed in a way that allows the attacker to practically pulverize all occupants of the underground structure. According to independent experts, the bomb, once detonated, produces rapidly expanding shock waves, flattening anything near the epicenter of the aerosol fuel cloud and capable of causing extensive damage far beyond the immediate strike area. In February of 2000, Human Rights Watch warned that fuel-air explosives, which are compared by some experts to low-yield nuclear bombs, could cause massive loss of life, especially in or near populated areas. Senior defense officials confirmed over the weekend the Pentagon is completing plans to send several hundred U.S. Special Forces soldiers to Yemen. The Pentagon is calling them military advisors. A U.S. military official quoted by the Wall Street Journal compared the potential mission to the U.S. commitment in the Philippines, where there are more than 600 troops. The U.S. is also preparing to send special forces to the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Indian police shot dead two people in the bloodied western state of Gujarat today as the death toll from the country's worst religious violence in a decade climbed well into the hundreds. The main opposition Congress Party said the death toll was more than 800, citing figures gathered by its offices across Gujarat, India's second most industrialized state. The violence was triggered by a train attack last week in which 58 Hindus burned to death. Since then, victims have told horrific tales of families being burned alive as raging crowds carrying swords, knives, and hockey sticks freely roam the streets and set fire to shops and houses. Thousands of supporters of Madagascar's opposition leader and self-declared president swarmed government ministries today in their first attempt to install alternative cabinet ministers into office. Despite martial law that was declared after election-related violence began to flare last week, soldiers guarding the finance ministry did not prevent the alternative finance minister from entering the building. Crowds also surrounded the energy and mines ministry. Opposition supporters had set up barricades and trenches throughout the city over the weekend to help prevent military vehicles from entering the capital. Unrest in Madagascar started after Marc Ravalomanana declared himself president 9 days ago. Disputing official election results, he said he won more than half the vote in the December 16th presidential race. More than 150 marchers gathered outside a federal courthouse in New York on Sunday to protest the overturning of the convictions of three white police officers in the torture case of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima. Meanwhile, the Reverend Al Sharpton meets today with New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly. Sharpton and other civil rights leaders are threatening mass protests and civil disobedience if the officers are allowed back on the force. Last Thursday, a federal appeals court ordered a new trial for Officer Charles Schwartz, who denies he was in the bathroom when Officer Justin Volpe sodomized Louima with a broken broomstick in 1997. The court also found there was insufficient evidence to sustain the obstruction of justice convictions of Schwartz and Officers Thomas Wiese and Thomas Bruder. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says President Bush's bid to allow oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and his nomination of U.S. District Judge Charles Pickering to the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals are dead. In an interview on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, Daschle said he would require at least 60 votes before allowing the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge drilling to be subject of a Senate floor vote. Meanwhile, California Democrat Senator Dianne Feinstein said the Senate Judiciary Committee will reject the Pickering nomination by a 10-9 party line vote. She has said it will not go to the Senate floor for a vote. Asked Sunday if that means the Pickering nomination is dead, Daschle said it is. Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter Liz Cheney will start work at the State Department within weeks as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Near East Bureau. State Department spokesperson Richard Boucher said she would have an economic portfolio, which another U.S. official described as a mandate to promote economic liberalization and U.S. trade and investment in the region. And you are listening to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe denounced his rival in presidential elections as a tool of white and foreign interests. The incumbent and challenger, Morgan Tsvangirai, began the final week of campaigning with rallies in Harare. We're going to have more on that story later in the week. And this news from Colombia, a senator and two companions who were trying to negotiate the release of rebel hostages were shot in the head and killed, apparently by the rebels, at least this according to Colombian police. The bodies of Colombian Senator Martha Catalina Daniels, her driver Carlos Lozano, and Ana Maria Medina were found Saturday in a deep ravine outside the town of Zipacan, 35 miles north of Bogota. Medina was the wife of a local politician who is being held hostage, apparently by the FARC. The three were trying to win the freedom of Medina's husband and a former mayor who were kidnapped in May. This according to a statement released by Colombia's intelligence police. And scores of captives from the Afghan war refused meals on Sunday at Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo, Cuba, in a protest that has lasted 5 days. But the U.S. military said only 13 of the 300 detainees had kept to the hunger strike since its start. Military officials presented the new tally after finishing a cell-by-cell count of those who'd refused food at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base detention site since the start of the protest on Wednesday. Previous estimates of the hardcore hunger strikers had been much higher. The hunger strikers say they're protesting an incident Tuesday in which a guard stripped a detainee of his turban during prayers. Since then, the military has said detainees can keep their turbans on, but must allow searches of them. And now we go to the occupied territories and Israel. Backed by tanks and helicopter gunships, Israeli troops carried out assault raids on two densely populated Palestinian refugee camps in the West Bank today. This came just hours after Ariel Sharon's government said it was intensifying its campaign in the occupied territories. Scores of Palestinians have been killed in what are now regular assaults on refugee camps. More than a dozen Israeli tanks and troops tore through the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. This weekend, ground troops backed by tanks and helicopter gunships moved from house to house in the Jenin and Balata camps. Despite Israeli claims to be hunting down what it calls militants or terrorists, reports from the camps say the assaults have indiscriminately killed civilians, including children. Refugees say 20 Palestinians have been held hostage in the Balata camp by the Israeli army in one building for 10 days. Neither the United Nations nor the International Committee of the Red Cross have been able to reach the building. Early today, a lone Palestinian sniper armed with an antiquated rifle opened fire on an Israeli military checkpoint in the West Bank, killing 10 people, 7 of them soldiers. On Saturday, a suicide bomber blew himself up in an ultra-Orthodox West Jerusalem neighborhood as Jewish residents poured out to celebrate a bar mitzvah. 9 people were killed. We go now to the West Bank and to Jerusalem. Quiva Butterly is with us, an activist with International Solidarity Action in the Balata refugee camp. And we're joined by Michelle Orshovsky. He's an Israeli peace activist, journalist, and former director of the Alternative Information Center, a joint Palestinian-Israeli organization. Michelle Orshovsky, let's begin with you. Can you describe the situation where you are in Jerusalem?
What is taking place is a huge use of violence by the Israeli occupation forces. Just now we heard in the radio that an ambulance was shot in a checkpoint and a doctor, and apparently more people were killed, and the two cars were bombed in Ramallah only the last hour, and the whole family killed. The army was claiming that it was a mistake. There is no limit anymore to the use of violence by the Israeli army and the Israeli government, which obviously, and everyone knows it in Israel, including in the government, would provoke retaliations from the Palestinians. Hamas already announced that they will retaliate for the assassination of the family in Ramallah.
Quiva Butterly, from your vantage point in Balata, can you describe the situation there now?
Days the governing families, and we did a more sort of comprehensive tour of the area today. There was a curfew effectively for about 3 days, so people really couldn't get out of their houses to assess the sort of overall damage. But particularly, I mean, we've been a tour this morning, and there really isn't a house that hasn't been trashed in the Balata camp. There were a series of beatings as the sort of searches of the house took place, ostensibly looking for weaponry. But as we've seen, it's just been a desecration, really. I mean, houses sort of trashed, people beaten in the process. I spoke to a family who was held for 4 days in a room, locked, in, about 12 of them, without any food or water, without access to a toilet. And when they came out of their house, they saw just wedding pictures sort of torn up and Stars of David painted everywhere. And, I mean, there's just obscene language basically painted everywhere. And, I mean, again, that's relatively minor to the more intense sort of form of violence here, which, I mean, we've accompanied the funeral procession today of four young men who were shot in the last 2 days. But it's been quite indiscriminate. I mean, I visited a series of women in hospital, you know, who were shot or hit by shrapnel. There's been children killed. It's a very bad situation.
What are people calling for in the Balata refugee camp right now?
I think everybody's still very much in a state of shock. People are very, very angry. The older people are definitely, I mean, they're calling for just a call to be regarded as human beings, not to be treated as, I don't know, I lived in Africa for a few years, and just touring around here, it's like a bad bit South Africa, you know, just such a blatant racism towards a group of people and such a blatant form of collective punishment. People are calling for, obviously, the things that they've been calling for years, but people are very angry, and I've spoken to a number of young people today, you know, who despite, I mean, the food situation is very bad here, but they were saying, you know, we don't need food, we need guns, and not necessarily like they say, you know, we recognize the humanity of Israelis, but the people who came in here were not human. I mean, they treated them like animals, and there's very much a feeling, you know, that they are completely defenseless, you know, that no matter what they do, they'll be labeled terrorists, whether they live in peace or whether there's a series of suicide bombs sort of continues, you know, that's really a no-win situation. And Balata particularly, I mean, it's one of the poorest areas, or one of the poorest refugee camps in Palestine. These are people really who have so, so very little, and the little that they have was desecrated in the last few days. But I mean, I visited a series of families today whose children are still in shock. I mean, they're just lying, shaking, because they were awoken from the night because their parents were beaten in front of them. There was a 15-year-old girl who, when she tried to come to her father's defense as he was beaten, was shot in the head. She's in critical condition. It's bad, bad, bad feelings.
And finally, Michelle Warshawski, where you are, what people are calling for right now in Jerusalem.
The streets are calling for revenge for the Israeli who have been killed in the recent operations in Jerusalem and around Jerusalem and in the occupied territories. Only a minority is calling to end immediately occupation because the occupation is the source of all this violence. And it has been proven that there will be no military way to stop the resistance of the Palestinians despite the huge price they have to pay. They are determined to resist and to expel the Israeli army from the occupied territory.
Michelle Warshawski, Israeli peace activist, journalist, and former director of the Alternative Information Center, a joint Palestinian-Israeli organization, speaking to us from Jerusalem, and Quiva Butterly, activist with International Solidarity Action in Balata refugee camp in the West Bank. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we turn to the great Indian writer Arundhati Roy, speaking to us from New Delhi. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. As the crisis in the occupied territories escalates, some of the worst ethnic fighting in decades has also erupted in another part of the world, in India. In the last 6 days alone, more than 500 people have been killed, many in clashes between Hindus and Muslims. As hundreds die in ethnic infighting in India, thousands continue to lose their lives and livelihoods to the privatization of essential resources like water and energy. While Enron has been by far the highest profile example of this kind of privatization, Enron was a household name in India years before its collapse made headlines in the United States. Another and equally disastrous example has been unfolding around the construction of big dams in the Narmada Valley. The valley is home to millions of people in central India, many whose families have been working its soil or fishing its rivers for generations. These days, however, it's also home to one of the country's largest big dam projects, a project which involves the construction of hundreds of dams in an extensive irrigation system. Among the most clarion and intrepid of voices in the fight against big dams has been that of the great writer Arundhati Roy. After publishing her acclaimed first novel, The God of Small Things, in 1997, Roy became increasingly active in the struggle for the Narmada Valley, as well as in struggles around nuclear disarmament, Enron, and most recently, the so-called War on Terror. But in a surreal twist, Roy's activism has recently led her to the brink of imprisonment. After defending herself in an impassioned affidavit against false charges of threatening the lawyers for the Narmada Valley Development Project, she was slapped with a contempt of court charge, which could send her to jail for up to 6 months. She'll be sentenced on Wednesday. I caught up with Arundhati Roy just before the ethnic violence began to escalate. I spoke to her in New Delhi and asked her about the court case that she now faces.
The court case, one has to see it at several different levels. One is the specific case, and one is the political context in which it's all happening. So I'll just talk about the specific case first, which is that basically I've been involved for some years now with this huge struggle against big dams that are being built in the Narmada Valley. And and for 5 or 6 years, the Supreme Court had ordered a stay against the Sardar Sarovar Dam, and suddenly in 1999 it partially lifted the stay, and in October 2000, in a final very controversial court judgment, ordered that the construction of the dam should go ahead, despite the fact that rehabilitation of the displaced people just had not taken place. So there was a big protest outside the gates of the Supreme Court in December 2000. I was there, as were hundreds of people from the Narmada Valley, who were people who had already been displaced by the dam at its existing height and had nowhere to go and so on. And they had come to protest against the judgment. And a few weeks later, what happened was that a group of five lawyers filed a case in the Supreme Court, which was an absolutely ludicrous case, claiming that me and Medha Patkar, who's the leader of the resistance movement in the valley, and the lawyer for that resistance movement, the NBA, it's called the Narmada Bachao Andolan, which means Save the Narmada. These lawyers claimed that we had tried to kill them and that we had raised these slogans against the court and so on. And even the local, I mean, there were hundreds of police there at the demonstration. There was the entire national media there. It was reported in every paper. And, of course, no such incident happened. I didn't even see these people. I don't even know who they were. And the Supreme Court actually accepted their petition, even though a local police station wouldn't accept the, you know, police report, the first information report. They wouldn't accept it. And the Supreme Court ordered us all to appear like criminals before the court and defend ourselves. So So I responded with an affidavit basically denying the charges, but also saying that, you know, the fact that the Supreme Court of India should accept such a technically flawed, ludicrous petition was somehow a sign that the court was harassing its critics and it was bringing its own reputation into disrepute. The court then dropped the petition, the charges made by the lawyers. They said, they themselves said this was a shocking petition, it was technically flawed, it should never have been accepted. And then the court let everybody off, including these lawyers with their false charges, and filed what is called a suo moto case against me. Suo moto means that the court itself charged me with contempt of court. And there have been several hearings now over the last year. And basically, the hearings were held virtually in camera. In India, courtrooms are supposed to be public, but no members of the public were allowed in. The judge who is judging it is the judge against whom supposedly the contempt happened. So, you know, he's judging his own case. And on the 6th of March, they've ordered me to be personally present in court while they read out the judgment. And the punishment for this could be, the maximum punishment is 6 months in prison. And I don't know whether I will be given a prison sentence or whether I'll be sort of publicly humiliated and let off or whether I'll be symbolically punished. I don't know what will happen. But that's just the specifics of this case. But on a much more serious level, you see, whatever happens to me, whether I get put into jail or whether I get let off, in a world where daisy cutters are being dropped on people, I can't make, you know, a prison sentence into a human rights case. But actually, the problem is a far more serious one. See, in India, what is happening is that all these institutions, whether it's the court, whether it's the executive, as in the parliament, or whether it's the local administrations, the police, and so on, are now being used as instruments in this whole process of corporate globalization that's taking place. And the Supreme Court is legitimizing huge decisions on privatization, on structural adjustment, all the decisions about whether there should be industry in Delhi or not, whether public sector units should be privatized or not, whether Enron should be proceeded against or not, whether slums should be cleared or not, whether a dam should be built or not. All these decisions are now being taken by the Supreme Court of India. It's wading into public life and making decisions that affect the lives of millions and millions of people. And this contempt of court law says that basically nobody can criticize the court. So in a sense, what you're seeing here is a retreat from democracy at a pace which is really frightening. And therefore, this case is important, where those of us who are involved in it, I mean, I'm the person whose head is in the noose just now, but many of us feel that this particular law should be struck down because it is anti-democratic and actually impedes free speech and free criticism.
What has been the reaction of your fellow and sister Indians to this case against you?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because on the one hand, I'd say that the majority of people don't know what the case really is because the press is frightened to report it because of the contempt of court law. So, and the press is not allowed into the courtroom by the police. And so there's a peculiar silence around it on the one hand. On the other hand, the you know, the silence is in the media, but the media in India, especially the English press, is not you know, is not read by the majority of people, because most of them can't read English. Most of them can't read. So the, but you know, the drum beat, like in, say, in the Narmada Valley, or in huge cases where people's movements have been struck down or, you know, really silenced by the Supreme Court, there's a tremendous amount of support. Yet in the established sort of middle class urban world, there's a silence. And there was also this effort to try and portray the whole thing as a very personalized thing, you know, this maverick writer versus the sort of august majesty of the Supreme Court, and to personalize it and to depoliticize it, which is, of course, an old trick. But that's what's going on just now here.
You mentioned Enron. Can you talk about the significance of Enron in India? I mean, I think in the United States, before Enron collapsed, it was not known very much. Yet in India, it was probably known a lot more.
Yeah, that's the peculiar thing, because Enron has been on the front pages of the papers in India since 1993, because when it was still this unknown company, it signed an agreement first with the Congress Party in Maharashtra and the Congress state government in Maharashtra, and then later on, after a lot of controversy, that particular contract was impugned, and then a new contract was signed with the ruling Shiv Sena and the BJP, which are these right-wing fundamentalist Hindu parties, which are in power today as well. They signed what is the biggest contract ever signed in the history of India for a power plant in Maharashtra. It was a $30 billion contract, which had a return on equity of something like 30% for Enron, which is completely illegal. It became hugely controversial because people who had studied the what is called the power purchase agreement, you know, came out with the analysis of it and said that this was the biggest fraud ever perpetrated in India, the most massive fraud, it's been called. And basically, 7 years after the contract was signed, everything that the critics of Enron said came true. Enron began to produce the most expensive electricity ever produced in India. Nobody could afford to buy it. So eventually it ended up with the state electricity board paying Enron just maintenance charges, which were something like, I don't know, $22 million a year or something, not to produce electricity. And this was the state of affairs. What has happened with Enron, as everybody knows now in America, is that it's exposed the rot and the lie in this whole issue of privatization. You know, the whole business of privatization as the alternative to a corrupt, inefficient state is such a piece of nonsense, because as you can see in the case of Enron in India, even really there was nothing private about Enron. Basically the only thing that was private were the profits, because all the risks were public. All the money that Enron put in, all the loans that it took, was underwritten by Indian financial institutions. So today, even though Enron is bankrupt, really the money is all from Indian financial institutions. So it doesn't help us that Enron is bankrupt. And while Enron is unraveling in America, George Bush has sent the U.S. Treasury Secretary, who, you know, by some quirk of fate is called Mr. Dam, to India to insist that we honor our contract with Enron and pay them a $1.2 billion exit payment. And so really, though Enron doesn't exist anymore, its liabilities and the mess that it's created is being borne by the poorest people in among the poorest countries in the world, as in America, by its shareholders and all that.
We're talking to the great writer Arundhati Roy, speaking to her in New Delhi, India, where she lives and works. You are listening to Democracy Now! How does Enron connect to the story of the dams that you have been so passionately fighting against?
Well, Enron doesn't directly connect to the story of the dams, but what it connects to is the fact is the story of the privatization of infrastructure. So now, they, for instance, in the Narmada Valley, they have the first privatized hydroelectric project, which is called the Maheshwar Dam. And structurally, the Maheshwar Dam is exactly the same as Enron. It's being presented to the people as a private project. But once again, the money is public. The government underwrites, you know, it does, as in the case of Enron, even here, they have what's called an escrow contract, where basically the government signs this contract with a private company with an escrow clause in it. And that means that whatever money comes into the government account, before the government pays its own employees, before it pays its workers, before it pays anything, the private company that runs this project has first call on that money, you know, regardless of how much electricity it's produced, regardless of how expensive that electricity may be. So this is the same thing that happened with Enron. So in India, you know, while people are fighting, say in America, you know, you have these huge protests against Nike and Starbucks and Kmart and things. In India, the biggest problem is the privatization of essential infrastructure. You know, so the privatization of water, the privatization of rivers, the privatization of electricity, which end up with dispossessing people on a barbaric scale. And, you know, you can't, and the whole thing is being presented as though it's a new alternative to what was undoubtedly an inefficient, corrupt state. But what I keep saying is that it's not an alternative. It's like saying, do you want a Coke or a Pepsi? Because the state is behind both. And really, the shift of power has just been from the bribe taker to the bribe giver. As you can see with Enron, it penetrated the entire state apparatus. So eventually, Kenneth Lay is interviewing people for the energy, for jobs in the energy ministry in America. You know, he's placing people there. He's writing the policies. So what's the difference? Corruption is not genetic to a government officer or a government servant. Corruption is linked to power. So if the state has the power, the state is corrupt. If that power shifts to the private sector is corrupt. So really the only alternative is to empower civil society. The only alternative is the politics of opposition, you know, the politics of demanding accountability, whether it's from the court, whether it's from the private sector, or whether it's from the government. There's no shortcut to that.
Arundhati Roy, the author of The God of Small Things and Power Politics. We'll be back with her in New Delhi in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we go back to the great writer Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things and Power Politics. She faces sentencing in court on Wednesday for her activism. This is the conversation I had with her several weeks ago in New Delhi.
Arundhati Roy, what does this have to do with the God of Small Things, which has won you such acclaim all over the world as an artist and a writer?
This has to do with the God of Small Things. If you were to reread the God of Small Things now, you'd see that it is about this. It is about all this. You know, it is about preserving. The God of Small Things is sort of patrolling the borders of humanity. I think saying, look, this is what we need to save, and these are the dangers that are really facing us today. And so many people ask me whether, you know, my next book is going to be about dams, and it makes me laugh because I think the God of Small Things is the fiction version of the algebra of infinite justice and all the, you know, or power politics and the understanding of all that in a way. But it's a very difficult thing for me to explain, but actually to me there isn't a difference between fiction and non-fiction. You know, there's a difference between truth and lies, but fiction sometimes is the truest thing that there ever was. So in bookshelves and in reviewers' minds and in publishers' minds, there are differences between fiction and non-fiction, but I don't really see that difference. You know, I just see all these things that I write as a way of presenting a way of seeing.
Can you explain what you mean by the algebra of infinite justice?
Well, I can actually, because I've been thinking about that a great deal. And what I mean by the algebra of infinite justice is really what it's really almost mathematical or arithmetical. What are the things that count in the calculus of power? Who are the people that count? Who are the people that don't count? Whether you look at you know, Madeleine Albright saying that 500,000 children dying in Iraq was a price worth paying, or whether you look at the war in Afghanistan and the fact that we don't even want to know, the world's media doesn't even want to know how many people were killed in Afghanistan, how many innocent people died in Afghanistan. We don't want to follow up on the UN report saying that 7.5 million people were about to starve. And suddenly it's off the news. So the only way of finding out is to go to Afghanistan. And if you can't go to Afghanistan, you don't know what happened. But they don't count anymore. So there are people in the world that count, and there are people in the world that don't count. And I'm not saying this is a genetic problem with the American state. It's true of any state, and the more powerful you are, the cruder the algebra of infinite justice becomes. But even, say, you look at the Narmada Valley. If you look at a dam project, you know, when I wrote my first essay on dams, what shocked me more than the facts that do exist are the facts that don't exist. That we didn't have any facts about how many people are displaced by big dams after all these years. If you look at the particular dam that I studied, who counts as an officially displaced person and who doesn't? The people who have land at least count as officially displaced. The people who don't have land but who, say, are fisher people or who are sand quarriers or people who belong to the lower castes in India who lose everything. They don't count as displaced people. So the fact that most of the, now we know because the World Commission on Dams came out with a report, India Country Study on the World Commission on Dams, estimates the number of displaced people as being 56 million. 56 million people. And we have no figures because most of those people are untouchables or indigenous people who don't count as people in the scheme of things. So that's what I mean by the algebra of infinite justice. Where you choose to draw the limits of your formula for your cost benefit analysis. When you have a war against Iraq or Afghanistan or any war, where do you choose to draw the limits of the damage that you've done? Is it just the number of people that you've killed? Does the fact that you've destroyed crops, the fact that whole generations might suffer in the future from cluster bombs, the fact that the animals and the fish and the grass and the insects and the air have been contaminated, do those things count or do they not? That's what I mean by the algebra of infinite justice.
Todd Gitlin, a writer in the United States, in a piece he did in Mother Jones magazine, you were also interviewed in the same issue, says, from the Indian novelist Arundhati Roy, who has admirably criticized her country's policies on nuclear weapons and development, came the queenly declaration that, quote, American people ought to know that it is not them but their government's policies that are so hated. He goes on to say, one reason why Americans were not exactly clear about the difference is that the murderers of September 11th did not trouble themselves with such nice distinctions. When Roy described bin Laden as, quote, the American president's dark doppelganger, and claimed that the twins are blurring into one another and gradually becoming interchangeable, she was in the grip of a prejudice invulnerable to moral distinctions. What is your response?
My response is that I'm not prejudiced against American people or against any people because I don't think in nations in that sense. But I think that anybody who justifies the bombing of Afghanistan is, in a way, in retrospect, justifying terrorism because this was a form of terrorism. And for me, the deep moral ambiguity that we have towards violence is what lies at the root of this. You know, so in fact, this whole debate about what is an acceptable war and what is a just war, again, it comes down to the issue of the algebra of infinite justice, you know, to say that, oh, we were dropping bombs, but we didn't intend to kill people, is such a piece of, fastidious shuffling about, trying not to take responsibility for what you're doing. And it is true. In fact, when people justify the sanctions against Iraq, that's what they say, that people should take responsibility for, the people of Iraq should take responsibility for the excesses of Saddam Hussein. Now, Saddam Hussein is a dictator. He's a military man. The people of Iraq are less responsible for him than the people of America are for their democratically elected government and its policies. But I do feel that here the American media does owe people an explanation because people are eventually a product of the information that they receive. And really on the 11th of September, the Twin Towers came down, but so did the twin myths of free speech and the free market.
What do you mean?
I mean that the American media and the way it reported this war, and what it chooses to write about and what it chooses to leave out, what it chooses to discuss and what it chooses not to, it was there for everybody to see what was going on after the 11th of September there. you know, the CNN saying don't report on civilian deaths in Afghanistan. And so the rest, the experience in the rest of the world of the 11th of September onwards was very different from the experience of the American people because of the way the American press was reporting it.
Can you talk about your role as an artist, as a writer, as an activist?
Well, I have written an essay about why I don't think of myself as an activist, because I just feel that I do what writers, I don't mean what writers should do, but what writers can do, you know, that the definition of writer should encompass what I do. Not that there should be any rules that all writers should do what I do. I don't mean that at all. But I see my role as being a perfectly normal thing for a writer to do. But one of the things that I feel very, very strongly about is that what's happening to the world today is just outside the grasp of ordinary people. You know, whatever it is, whether it's what's happening in the Narmada Valley or whether it's what's happening, say, with me and the Supreme Court just now, or whether it's the whole issue of what is globalization? What does it mean? What is it doing to us? Now, I think that we live in an era where experts have captured little pieces of territory and carried them off to their lairs, and they guard them against the unauthorized curiosity of people passing by, almost as if you want to make things so complicated that ordinary people can't understand. You want to professionalize things. Lawyers want to professionalize things so that they are needed, you know, so that ordinary people can't understand what's going on in a court. Architects want to do the same thing with design. And I feel that it's very important to somehow grab this back, not to vulgarize it, not to simplify it, but to try and explain what's going on in the world. Why are people being deprived of their livelihoods in the name of corporate globalization? What is corporate globalization? What is privatization? What does it mean? And I think as a writer, you know, that's where I try and tell the story. Tell the story of the Narmada Valley in all its detail to people who don't quite understand it, to ordinary people who don't quite understand it.
Are you afraid to go to jail?
Some days I am, some days I'm not. You know, some days I'm so angry that I don't care. And some days I'm not scared, but I'm just, let's say, thoughtful because, you know, obviously you're very vulnerable when you're there. I don't mean that anything is going to happen to me, but I just mean, you know, it's frightening to be controlled by the people that you're fighting against in some way. But I have to say that maybe I'm being cheeky and maybe I'm being optimistic, but I think that I don't think that they'll put me into jail. I think they'll try to humiliate me in other ways, but I think it would be I don't know. Anyway, I don't even want to speculate, but this is, you see, the problem in India is this is the whole business with courts. It's not whether they put you into jail or not. That's not what is the biggest harassment, is this thing of going for court hearings, appearing personally, having to spend your life with lawyers. You know, this is the punishment. I've already had the punishment. The jail or no jail is just the end of it. But the punishment has already been, I've already been through it. So in a way, now I may as well fit you know, I may as well commit the crime to fit the punishment. I may as well talk about what the role of the courts is in all these issues and so on, which I haven't really done before.
In the escalating tensions between India and Pakistan, how do they affect you personally?
They affect me in as much as one sees the absolutely puerile, instigation of the basest feelings on both sides, and it's very frightening to be in the middle of it, and to know that, you know, anything that you're saying, after all, the fight for the dam, say, the fight in the Narmada Valley, it's a fight for life. You know, it's a fight for the beauty of a river, for the forests, for the fish, for the flowers, for those things. And to know that up against you are people who are both, I mean, and I'm not talking about India and Pakistan, again, you know, I mean, America and Osama bin Laden and everybody's involved in this absolutely terrifying world where you know, nuclear weapons are being pointed at each other, and the knowledge that you're up against people who are comfortable with the notion of a wasted world. For them, what's a wasted valley? Nothing, you know. So that's very unnerving. To know how little what you're saying actually counts, whatever, you know, however much attention one is given or whatever it is, you know, the interviews you do or the prizes you win or all that, it's just nothing compared to the absolute contempt that the establishment has for what one is saying.
Arundhati Roy, the author of The God of Small Things and Power Politics. She was speaking to us from New Delhi, India. She will be sentenced in court on Wednesday for her protest against privatization in India. If you'd like to get more information, you can go to our website at democracynow.org or to southendpress.org, the publisher of Power Politics. Coming up this week on Democracy Now!, Fred Hampton Jr. and Ded Prez talking about their trip around college campuses dealing with issues of police brutality. Fred Hampton Jr.'s father, Fred Hampton, was assassinated by the Chicago police in 1969. Also, a debate on Zimbabwe. The Zimbabwean elections are coming up this week as well. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Salone is our music maestro and engineer. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Broadcasting from the studios of Downtown Community Television, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.